The table saw is by far the most dangerous tool that's used by woodworkers and do-it-yourselfers. According to government data, more than 3,000 people in the U.S. cut off their fingers or thumbs with table saws every year. NPR's Chris Arnold has been following one entrepreneur who's developed a safety device that prevents those injuries. It's called SawStop, and it works. But the power tool industry has not adopted it. That's led to a growing number of lawsuits.
A table saw has an open spinning blade the size of a dinner plate with sharp, jagged teeth. Often there's no guard attached to protect the person using it. The blade spins so fast that it's hard to see. So if you lose your concentration for just half a second and put your hand in the wrong place, you can lose your fingers before you even feel the pain.
You can't react fast enough. It's happened before you realize it's happened.
Chris Higginbotham is a wood shop teacher at Forest Grove High School in Oregon. In his class here, about 25 teenagers are using table saws and other power tools. You might think that's an accident waiting to happen. And Higginbotham is painfully aware that they do happen.
I had a young man. He paid attention. He did a great job on the safety test. He's well behaved. And he just made a mistake. In an instant, his index finger was gone up to the middle knuckle. And there's nothing left to put back on. And that was pretty traumatic. I feel horrible even just talking about it now.
Several thousand Americans cut their fingers off every year on table saws. Some cut off 3 or 4 fingers. But these days, Chris Higginbotham is a lot less worried about accidents. That's because the table saws that he's using are made by a company called SawStop. And they have a super fast safety brake mechanism that can sense when the blade makes contact with a finger.
I absolutely know it saved the kid's thumb. He would have lost his thumb.
The entrepreneur who invented this safety brake actually lives just a few miles from here. His name is Steve Gass. He's a woodworker, a physicist, and a patent attorney. We first did a story on him 6 years ago when he launched his company. And he agreed to come by the class here today to show the students how the saw works.
I'm going to put this hot dog on top of the board here as if it was my thumb misplaced in the path of the blade.
And then it turns out that a hot dog has about the same salt and moisture content as a human finger. The SawStop saw induces a very slight electrical current on the blade. That's monitored by a computer chip. Wood does not conduct electricity. But your finger, it turns out, does. And the saw can sense the difference between the two and trigger a safety brake. When that happens, the blade slams down into the table and away from the person's hand.
1 minute, the saw is running full speed with the blade up fairly high. And just in a thousandth of a second, it's just gone. I mean, it doesn't just stop. The whole blade's gone.
You can see a video of this hot dog demo at NPR.org. Steve Gass first invented this technology back almost 10 years ago, and he's tried ever since to get the big power tool companies to license and use it.
They came back and said, well, we've looked at it, but we're not interested because safety doesn't sell. And I thought, what a crazy attitude.
Over the past decade, Gass says all of the major power tool makers, Black & Decker, Ryobi, Skill Bosch, Makita, and others, they still haven't adopted this type of safety system. So his startup company has been manufacturing saws, and so far he says he's documented 700 saved fingers.
We ended up having to build the saws ourselves to get them out there, and it has sold. It's become the number one selling table saw, cabinet table saw in the country. And so it sort of proved how wrong those guys were.
Gass says SawStop is number one in the higher-end so-called cabinet saw part of the market, but the vast majority of table saws sold still do not have this kind of safety brake. Gass says it's basically like refusing to put airbags in cars. Recently, though, Steve Gass has gained a pretty powerful ally.
It is really a shocking lack of concern for the safety of their customers.
Stuart Singer is a partner in the law firm Boies, Schiller & Flexner. It's a high-profile firm that successfully sued Microsoft on behalf of the U.S. Justice Department in a famous antitrust case. The firm has now joined the fight, and it's representing injured people and suing power tool companies. Stuart Singer.
We have approximately 50 such cases that are pending in various courts around the United States, and we anticipate more of them will be filed.
In just a single case, the firm recently won a $1.5 million verdict against the power tool maker Ryobi.
Our hope is that we don't have to try 50 cases before we convince the industry that they need to change table saws, that they need to use an available safety technology to protect customers.
The power tool companies argue that they have been making their saws safer. The industry recently adopted new standards for better guards to cover saw blades, and they're adding a feature that prevents wood from getting thrown back at the person who's using the saw. Susan Young is a spokesperson for the Power Tool Institute, which represents the major toolmakers. She declined an interview, but read from a statement.
The members of the Power Tool Institute continue to devote substantial time and resources in the research, development, testing, and implementation of improved table saw guard designs and other safety measures.
Part of the debate here boils down to cost. SawStop says the safety brake system adds about $100 to the manufacturing cost. On top of that, SawStop would want royalties. On a high-end $3,000 saw, that might not be a big deal, but you can also buy a cheap small table saw for around $100. Adding SawStop or a similar safety system would probably double that price. Stuart Singer says that's just what a responsibly built saw should cost. The industry argues, though, that it's unreasonable to force consumers to pay for more safety if they don't want it.
It could increase the consumers' costs of table saws.
Meanwhile, government regulators could step in. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission's new chairman, Inez Tannenbaum, is taking an interest in SawStop. Founder Steve Gass recently showed her how the saw works.
I was extremely impressed with the speed by which the blade stopped upon contact with human skin. And I recognized that his SawStop does prevent amputations and maimings from the table saw incidents.
Steve Gass, actually back in 2003, petitioned this agency to require this technology on table saws. Tannenbaum would prefer to see the industry adopt the technology voluntarily. But so far, that hasn't happened. And in those past 7 years, according to the CPSC's own data, tens of thousands of people have had their hands mangled and their fingers chopped off on table saws.
I believe that if we don't see a voluntary standard soon, then we should look at making this product a part of our rulemaking so that we can build that in it in terms of a mandatory standard. If we have something that can prevent injury, we need to act upon it now.
The chairman has not yet asked the industry to voluntarily implement a safety brake like SawStop. If and when she does that, she'd give the companies several months to respond before seeking new regulations. In the meantime, the lawsuits continue, and so do the injuries. About 10 people every day in the U.S. are getting their fingers cut off on table saws. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Laws that ban texting while driving are increasingly popular as states try to reduce the number of car crashes. According to the Transportation Department, nearly 6,000 people died in accidents related to distracted driving in 2008. So, six new texting bans go into effect this month, including one in Georgia, where NPR's Kathy Lohr filed this report.
On the north side of Atlanta, on a sweltering summer morning, stop-and-go traffic creeps by off State Route 400. The heat seems to rise from the pavement as Sergeant Robert Moody with the Georgia State Patrol scans for drivers who appear to be texting.
She's looking down, and she's texting with her left hand, and she actually changed lanes from right to her left and continuing on. That was an obvious violation of this new law.
Sergeant Moody says it's easier than you might think to figure out if someone is typing a message behind the wheel. People often weave in and out of lanes, and they drive slower.
If you're looking down and you're not paying attention to the road, you may let off the gas, and all of a sudden, instead of running 55-60, you're running 35-40. So those kind of things law enforcement can look for. Once we see those violations, why did that violation occur?
If there's an accident, driver's cell phone records could be subpoenaed. As of today, Georgia bans all phone use for drivers under 18, and it's one of 28 states that prohibit text messaging for all drivers.
I think a lot of it comes down to common sense.
Bob Dallas is director of the Governor's Office of Highway Safety in Georgia. He says officers will have a lot of discretion in writing tickets. The penalty here, a $150 fine and 1 point assessed against your driver's license. Dallas says lawmakers had a good reason for the stiff fine.
They did look at some of the other states that had low fines or no points, and what they found was that there wasn't significant compliance associated with that. And that's one of the issues. We don't just want to put a law on the books and nobody pay attention to it.
According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, fines across the country range from as little as $20 to as much as $750 for a violation. Getting people to comply with the new distracted driving law is a priority and the focus of a new radio campaign hitting just before the holiday weekend.
Police are teaming up to crack down on Georgia's deadliest drivers. Cops are on the lookout for drunk drivers and putting the brakes on texting behind the wheel, too.
Georgia and other states are looking to places where bans are already in effect to see how enforcement is working.
It takes ongoing outreach and education. It takes that messaging over and over again. And unfortunately, for some people, it takes something terrible to happen before they're true believers.
Pam Fisher is with the New Jersey Division of Highway Traffic Safety. She says officers are writing 10,000 tickets every month.
The problem is that we have far more folks breaking the law than we have police officers available to write tickets. So we have a huge challenge here.
Fisher says that challenge is changing people's attitudes, and that doesn't happen in an instant. In the meantime, there is little data about how well the laws work to reduce crashes. A study released this year by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety showed cell phone and texting bans in several states, including New York and California, had no impact on accidents. Many, including U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, downplayed the results, saying enforcement will make a difference. Back on the road, Sergeant Moody with the Georgia State Patrol continues to note texting violations.
I do not look at this as an enforcement challenge. I think it will be a learning curve for all involved.
Officers in Georgia say they'll give drivers several weeks to get used to the ban on texting and wait until August to strictly enforce it. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Among the many fascinating facts we've learned about the 11 alleged Russian spies arrested earlier this week by the FBI, here's one that stood out. They sometimes communicated by embedding hidden messages in image files, which they posted on the internet. This idea of hiding a message in something else is an ancient one. It's called steganography, from the Greek steganos, meaning covered, so covered writing. These days, computer programs can insert encrypted messages into seemingly ordinary text, image, or sound files. And here to explain is Dartmouth College computer scientist Hani Farid. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And before we get to this modern-day application, why don't you talk a bit about the ancient ways people would use steganography?
Yeah, so what's great about this technology is although there is this modern-day version that we have in the digital world, it dates back thousands of years. My favorite example of this is that the Greeks, when they wanted to send a message to their generals in the field, would tattoo a message into the back of the head of a messenger, allow the hair to grow back, and then send the messenger along the way. The idea being, of course, that if they were intercepted, there would be nothing on their physical person that would reveal what the message was. But of course, at the other end, when they arrived, they would shave the head and there would the message would be.
Okay, well, a bit of evolution from the Greeks to now. What allegedly did the Russian spies do? How would you do this if you wanted to get a text message inside, say, a picture?
It's actually a fairly easy thing to do because you can just download software. There are literally hundreds of freely available software packages. And the way the software works is very simple. You give it one image, which we call the cover. That's the innocuous image of the cat, your backyard, a birthday party, and your message. And the software simply combines them together. And then that image can be either posted on a web page, sent over an email. And then, of course, at the other end, when it's received, the same software extracts the message out.
And according to the criminal complaint in this case, the images that they were looking at appear, as they say it, wholly unremarkable to the naked eye. You really can't tell.
That's exactly right. So the beauty of this technology is you can take any digital image, and because the internet has so many images floating around, there's just no way that anybody, by simple visual inspection, could have determined that there was a message embedded within it.
And you're saying this is an easy thing to do.
Anybody can do it. So go onto your favorite internet search engine, type steganography software download. Open the software. It's as simple as using Word, really. It doesn't require any particularly high-tech technology or training of any sort.
What would the advantages be of using steganography, over sending an encoded email message or something like that?
If I'm somebody at my home and I encode a message or encrypt a message, which takes a normal message, whether it's text or an image, and scrambles it so that it's incomprehensible, and I transmit that to somebody, it looks a little suspicious because the average person doesn't do that. The beauty of steganography is that it doesn't look suspicious. You're simply sending a photograph to somebody.
The way that this was discovered wasn't because the FBI happened to find these images and know to decode them. They found it in a physical search. They found the password for this program in the apartment of some of the defendants here, apparently.
That's exactly right. In fact, that's the very nature of steganography, is that even if they had found the images on the computer, they wouldn't have known that there was a message in it unless they had actually found the software. Now, there are scientists, such as myself, who are developing computer programs that can determine whether images or sound files contain an embedded message, even when you can't see or hear it.
I would bet that's a growth industry right now.
Yeah, I mean, and the cases like this actually highlight the need for this. The fact is we don't really know how prevalent this is, but we do know that some organizations and some individuals are using this technology, and because of its very nature, it's a fantastic covert technique that is very hard to detect.
Hani Farid, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hani Farid is professor of computer science at Dartmouth. He was talking about the art and science of steganography.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. If you ever walked through a train station or airport in Europe or visited a cathedral there, you may have noticed one of the many blue signs of a human ear with the words hearing loop installed written underneath. The signs are a cue to the deaf or to hearing impaired. Flip a little switch on your hearing aid and you can tune it to specially broadcast announcements sent directly into your ear. Kind of like Wi-Fi for hearing aids. For those with hearing problems, it can make hearing a totally different experience. The technology is relatively cheap. It's simple. But even though an estimated 36 million Americans have some level of hearing loss, it doesn't seem to have caught on here in the U.S., at least not yet. Joining me now to tell us more about hearing loops and how they work is a man who is pioneering an effort to get them installed everywhere. David Myers is professor of psychology at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. He is also a loop hearing system user. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Myers.
Thank you, Ira. I'm delighted to be with you.
Why is it called a loop? Is there a real loop in there?
Oh, there actually is a real loop. The system consists of an amplifier, which connects to some sound source, could be a home TV or an auditorium PA system or perhaps a microphone behind a ticket window. And then there is indeed a wire loop that goes out from that amplifier and which transmits a magnetic signal. And that signal can be picked up either by a portable receiver and headset or more commonly by an inexpensive little magnetic sensor called a telecoil that's tucked inside one's hearing aid or cochlear implant. So just to give you an example, right here in my Hope College office, I've got an amplifier that takes the signal off my telephone. A wire encircles me underneath the carpet. And because I've activated the telecoils in my hearing aids, voila, I can hear your questions broadcast by both my hearing aids. When you're talking, I could put the phone on the desk, walk around the office, and I'd hear you just perfectly clearly through both hearing aids, which have become in-the-ear loudspeakers for me.
Let me give my listeners a little bit of a comparison of what it sounds like without the loop and with the loop. Let's go first to a sound without the loop.
We do. We have to. We earn the voice.
Now, that's what it sounds like in a cathedral, right?
Yeah. And that's much like what I experienced about 10 years ago when I first visited the Iona Abbey off the west coast of Scotland. That sound was indecipherable to me after reverberating off those 800-year-old stone walls.
Mm-hmm. And here's what it would sound like if you had the loop installed.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
What a difference.
For he today that
And indeed, what a difference it was for me when my wife noticed the hearing assistance sign on the wall and nudge me to experiment with these telecoils and these new hearing aids I had. It was just an incredible kind of transforming experience for me. All of a sudden, this clear voice was talking from the center of my head.
And you didn't realize that your hearing aid even had the little coil in it.
I think my audiologist had mentioned it to me because I did know that these telecoils have another very important use, which is why really the Hearing Loss Association of America recommends them for all hearing aids now, and that is that, unbeknownst to most of your listeners, I suspect, all landline telephones in the United States and now select models of cell phones broadcast not only sound, but also a magnetic signal. And these hearing aid-compatible phones allow me to turn on a telecoil in one of my hearing aids, put the phone up. The hearing aid now becomes an earplug, and it receives a stronger, clearer signal. It's the same magnetic induction technology that's used with hearing loops that also works for a telephone conversation.
Now, you were saying that all over Europe, they have these loops at airports and other kinds of places.
Oh, yeah. In the United Kingdom and the Nordic countries, they're just everywhere. They're in the back seats of all London taxis, which have a little microphone embedded in the dashboard in front of the driver, at 18,000 post offices in the UK, at most churches and cathedrals, and you just see them everywhere.
And why don't we have them here, then?
Well, you know, we've gone with a different technology that's largely hearing aid incompatible. It requires you to check out equipment. And if you put yourself in the position of a person with hearing loss, you're sitting in an auditorium or at worship, you're having trouble hearing, which of these two systems would you prefer? Would you prefer to have to get up out of your seat, go locate, check out, and wear some conspicuous equipment? Or would you prefer just to press a button and instantly have your hearing aids become wireless loudspeakers delivering customized sound for your own needs? It's the latter system that we're pushing for, a lot of us now in the United States, because it's much, much more likely to be used.
Is it hard to install such a system?
It is a little harder and more costly to install because you've got to run the wire. And for that reason, the installation does cost a little more, and many audio engineers therefore find it a little less convenient to install. But the cost per user turns out to be much, much less because you have so many more people using it.
Mm-hmm. It must, you know, be something that you're working very hard to get installed around the country.
Oh, yeah. We're, you know, I created an informational website, hearingloop.org, and I have written a couple dozen articles. But now there's some wonderful people all over the country. Hearing Access Program in New York City has been instrumental in New York City Transit's installing hearing loops in the subway information booths right underneath you. That's going on now. A national service organization, Sertoma, is now promoting it through its 540 local clubs across America. Hearing loss groups in central Wisconsin, in Arizona, Chicago, New Mexico, Silicon Valley, Florida, and are all promoting it. And the big new news is that the Hearing Loss Association of America, which is the national support and advocacy organization for people with hearing loss, and the American Academy of Audiology have jointly launched an initiative to promote the transformation of American assistive listening towards this hearing aid compatible assistive listening.
Now, if I had a church, a synagogue, any place I'd like to install one, what could I expect to have to pay for this?
A small to medium sized congregation would typically be in the $2,000 to $8,000 range, although that depends on whether it's a frame construction or has a lot of embedded steel in it.
Mm-hmm. And if you really had a big system like a train station, it would cost significantly more, I imagine.
Yes. And so, for example, Grand Rapids Airport cost for the installation that covered both its concourses and all its gate areas $137,000.
That's not a lot.
No. And for the home TV loop systems, and these really work cool, by the way. I mean, they're like $140 to $300.
And it makes such a difference. We have one more example of what kind of difference it could be. And this is really something you experience. And those of us who have some sort of hearing loss and who doesn't, here's an example of what Grand Rapids Airport sounds like before and after. Let's listen to before.
Now the boat. That concludes all bags off American Eagle Flight 4033, service from Chicago. If you're not seeing your bag or just have some further questions, please see an agent at the American.
All right, that's before the loop and now after the loop.
That concludes all bags off American Eagle Flight 4033, service from Chicago. If you're not seeing your bag or just have some further questions, please see an agent at the American Eagle Ticket.
Wow, what a difference.
Oh, and what a huge difference for anybody with hearing aids who really has hearing needs, because as I've waited for my delayed flights in Grand Rapids Airport, I just activate my telecoil, and they become in-ear loudspeakers. I can hear those announcements as clearly as you could, Ira.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of efforts are you making? Where do you go from here with this?
Well, the push, really, is to try to encourage places of worship to adopt this, to educate audio engineers, architects, and facilities planners, and to educate hearing professionals themselves and the general public. And that's part of the the push that's going to be going on this next year, culminating in a national conference a year from now, co-hosted by the Hearing Loss Association of America and the American Academy of Audiology.
Good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Anybody's welcome to visit hearingloop.org.
There you go. David Myers, professor of psychology at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, talking about the Hearing Loop.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thousands of birds and other wildlife have died in the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, and now marine biologists are increasingly worried about sea turtles. Each year, thousands of baby sea turtles scramble from their nests in the Florida Panhandle sandy beaches and Alabama's coast into the water. But if those Gulf waters are followed by oil and chemical dispersants, a whole generation of sea turtles could be harmed, even destroyed. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is attempting a daring rescue to save those hatchlings. We're joined now by agency spokesman Chuck Underwood at member station WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. Mr. Underwood, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
How are you going to try and save these sea turtles?
Well, biologists have been working for the past 8 weeks on a plan that has been developed to actually physically relocate the nests that are along the northern Gulf Coast of Florida and Alabama, and take those nests over to the east coast of Florida, where they'll be allowed to complete their incubation, and hopefully the turtles will emerge, we can collect them, and release them to the ocean.
What's that involve, moving the nests of sea turtles?
Oh, this is an extraordinary effort under some very extraordinary circumstances. We've got 700 to 800 nests that are located along these beaches. That represents anywhere from 50 to 70,000 individual hatchlings and eggs. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do now is we've developed some protocols. We've got people who are already permitted. They've already been out for the past 3 months marking nests as they are laid, collecting data for us. At some point in a couple of weeks, we will begin to actually be able to go out physically by hand, dig these nests up, place them in styrofoam containers, and prepare them for transport to the other side of Florida.
And when you talk about transport, I mean, they don't make baby seats for baby turtle hatchlings, right?
No, they do not. What we've done is we looked at a variety of options for us, everything from just basic vans to using aircraft. We thought at one point, in fact, the plan act, as it's written right now, actually calls for aircraft transport. Decided that it was inherently too dangerous to the eggs with takeoff turbulence and potential weather delays. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, there's actually companies out there who have specialized equipment, and FedEx has stepped up to the plate to do that.
FedEx?
FedEx.
Who signs for the delivery?
We actually have biologists at the other end who would be happy to sign for those deliveries.
Where will they be transported?
They're going to be moved from up and down the coast. The FedEx will go through each day that we have collections made and then transport them over to the Kennedy Space Center. The Space Center has provided the opportunity for us to utilize one of their large climate-controlled warehouses. They have a wildlife contractor on staff that is used to handling wildlife, so they've offered that up to us, and that's a great opportunity for us.
My gosh, so you have this uncommon mutual effort between the latest space technology and, if I might put it this way, one of the oldest technologies of all.
That is correct. It's a very unique situation for us. We have a lot of partners involved that normally would not necessarily all agree to something, but the general consensus is this is at least an opportunity to try to do something in a situation that has been less than ideal for wildlife and will continue to be so in the near future.
And I have to ask, Mr. Underwood, there must be some risk, which I imagine you've calculated, to the hatchlings themselves.
This is one of the reasons we refer to this as an extraordinary effort. This has got just tons and tons of potential risk to it. This is not the best solution. This is the least offensive solution of a bunch of poor solutions. We know with some certainty that if we don't do something, these hatchlings are going to emerge. They're going to go into the Gulf, and the chance in the Gulf would be almost nil. So this is an effort to do what we can. We've tried to minimize the risk, manage those risks to the greatest extent possible, but we do expect that we will, in fact, cause some additional losses.
Yeah. And is there also some risk after they arrive, and does it foul up their internal guidance system?
Those are some of the things we don't know. Once we get them there and they emerge, there's a lot of questions. Are they going to be put on the beach and released into the surf? And are they going to go into the ocean like they would normally do? Or are they going to do circles? We just honestly don't know. Mm.
So on the whole, you've chosen to take this risk, which at least has the promise of giving them a chance at life, whereas if you left them in the Gulf, it sounds as if they'd have no chance whatsoever.
That is correct. We at least give them a chance to get out there. We're not impacting the sea turtle population that's already along the Atlantic side. Many of these turtles that emerge from the northern Gulf nest end up on the Atlantic side naturally anyway, as they get caught into the currents and follow the currents around, the loop current around the Keys. So that would not be unusual.
And, you know, they're in unfamiliar waters there. Where will they wind up?
We won't know for 35 years. This is a very slow maturing species. That 35 years from now, they will reach their sexual maturity and begin coming back to the beaches. At that point, we might be able, through some genetics, figure out which of the turtles coming back on board, particularly the young turtles, might be from the North Gulf. They may end up coming right back to the Eastern Atlantic. We just don't know.
Chuck Underwood, Public Information Officer at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, speaking from Jacksonville, Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
In the days before delete buttons, writers rubbed out a word they wished to change and wrote over it. This week, the Library of Congress announced that hyperspectral imaging has revealed that in a rough draft of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson referred to people living in Britain's American colonies as our fellow subjects. At some point, he had a better idea. He rubbed out our fellow subjects and wrote citizens. The change was revolutionary. It announced that he and the Founding Fathers didn't just want to get King George III to change his ways, then go back to being happy British subjects. They sought to create a new country. Hyperspectral imaging is an extraordinary technology, but like all new technologies, it has some risky implications. But if scientists use hyperspectral imaging to go over an early scroll of the Ten Commandments and find out there are a couple more that some early scribe wrote over, or what if underneath, thou shalt not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor, they find that someone had rubbed out until the new iPhone comes out. But if they go further down in the Declaration of Independence and discover that Mr. Jefferson first wrote that men have certain unalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of harpsichords. Uh-oh, misprint. You're listening to NPR News.